Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. We have returned your co-hosts, Joe Hagan and Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hello, we're back again.
And a lot has happened this week. A lot's about to happen next week. You know, late last year, we kept promising we were going to stop talking about Trump.
We kind of have.
And we did for a while. We did so good for a while there. But you know what? The truth is, I've had a change of thinking about this.
Ooh.
I'm realizing that we're not thinking about Trump in the same way. We're not thinking about it as if we're beholden to his horror show. We are now doing the good, hard work trying to, A, achieve some kind of justice, but also metabolize and deal with the fallout of what he did and what he meant. And interestingly enough, it's all in the court of the Republicans now. They are now suffering the slings and arrows of their own calculations that they made by following Trump to begin with.
Well, that's what your interview today is all about. I want to hear all about it. But before we get there, you know, I really feel like my day-to-day is so much less ruled and governed by former President Trump. I honestly don't think about him every day, which is such a change because I feel like I only used to think about him. And there are some days where I just feel like that era is totally over and what happened was it was just a different time and he is completely irrelevant. And because I have that mental shift and because it feels so good, a few times this week, I have said to myself, I almost wish impeachment was not happening because he's going to be back in the daily discourse in a way that I have grown so accustomed to him not being now. And even though it's only been 2 weeks, I feel like I don't want to return to that state of being and state of mind. I know intellectually and morally it is the right thing to do. There have to be consequences for what he fomented and what he was a leader of. That's just democracy. And if we don't stand up for that, I don't know what we stand for. But I also think the fact that he has been so quiet has given us a false sense that he is so behind us because it's a strategy. He's not been quiet because he is irrelevant and that Trumpism is now completely gone because he's no longer in office. He's been quiet because he doesn't want to rile up any kind of Republican sentiment like what we had on January 7th or 8th, where it really looked like if the Senate were to impeach him, you know, he would actually get impeached, that the Republican senators and Congress people had a real momentum and real incentive to do something about it. It was so fresh. It was so raw. It was so clear what the president had done. And now with some time and some distance, as Mitch McConnell designed it, it looks as though the Senate Republicans will not have spines, will not stand up for democracy, and will not vote to convict him. And so I think the president, for the first time in the last 5 years, has exercised real self-control because he knows what's on the line for him. If he does not, he has not appeared on Fox News. He has not appeared on OAN. He has, obviously, he doesn't have Twitter, but he has other means if he wanted to talk to people and say things that are unhinged or against his better interests, but he has been very disciplined in not doing that. So I think as much as I've been dreading having him back in our conversation because of impeachment next week, I also just want to keep our eyes open that once impeachment concludes, however, whichever way it goes, Trump will be unleashed again. That the strategy will be over.
Yeah. And that's true. And the reason he's being quiet is he knows that if he doesn't want to add fuel.
Exactly.
And give these senators a reason to impeach him exactly. and to end his political future.
So I worry about March. And I know that you get into this in your interview, and I want to hear what you said. But I know a lot of people are banking on the fact that either there will be a Republican civil war or Trumpism will just be done and dusted, and this will be the last we hear of it. But I strongly feel in my gut the Republican civil war lasted about 6 days, and yeah. it is the party of Donald Trump. And maybe that helps Democrats win.
I think it does. I was about to say that, you know, this guy that I'm having on today, Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, you know, he's hoping that they can overcome Trump so that they can be a party that is functional, that they can actually be a functional opposition to the Democrats. In truth, if they're warring with the Trumpers for the next 2 years, they're just going to split their party in half and give the, you know, hand the keys to the Democrats, which is actually what McConnell, the reason he's so betwixt and between right now and trying to thread the needle, is he knows exactly this, that if they can't, you know, contain or put back in the box this, you know, maniacal, you know, insurrectionist wing, that, you know, Democrats are going to win. And now the guy that we're going to be speaking with today, he's maybe just politically, it's in his interest to say he's optimistic about this, but he seems to be optimistic that they will overcome this Trump thing, that in fact, the bloom will be off the rose of Trump as the base begins to recede from its passions. Like there'll be some, you know, there was a quote, which I'd mentioned to him in this interview, from an ally of Liz Cheney's, who had believed in the election fraud, and that when she came out of it, she said she felt like she was coming out of a fog. And I don't know to the degree to which how many of these people are going to come out of their fog, right? But the truth is that if Trump comes back out and they circle the wagons, the Jim Jordans, the Ted Cruzes, the Josh Hawleys, they can keep these people on the reservation by continuing to feed them that chum again. And that's when we'll find out. When they come back and try to reanimate all those Trump passions, whether that base keeps responding again, if they stay put.
Yeah, I mean, they have to be, if you are radicalized, you have to continue to be radicalized. And we've had this like tiny period of time where that's quieted down. I'm personally not optimistic that the radicalization just completely stops after, you know, probably right. a decade going in one direction, that that one person leaves office and suddenly it's done. That seems irrational to me. And it seems right. like something that's born out of like the people who don't believe that, who have not been rationalized, like just desperate for that to be the case. So I think the only solution is to keep your eyes open, to watch for that radicalization and to counter it with fact. And I think people are going to have to start answering for the radicalization, which I think is different. Exactly. Under Trump, they were given cover and they were in power. And now the people who are living in a different, dangerous reality are answering for it. And what I think we're going to start to see is with that vote on so-called MTG, Marjorie mm-hmm. Taylor Greene. I heard this said before, and I truly, truly believe it. The left should do to MTG what the right did to AOC. The right has made AOC the face of the Democratic Party when she had no business being the face of the Democratic Party. She didn't ask for that. She doesn't hold enough power for that. She doesn't have, like, she's not actually the face of the Democratic Party. It's a branding thing, right? Fox did it so well. No one is a better brand engine than Fox News and frankly, President Trump. And so they made an election issue or two election issues basically out of AOC and the so-called squad, right? They said, if you vote
That's
for
right.
any Democrat, Joe Biden, you're voting for AOC, who, you know, frankly, she's one single congresswoman, a freshman congresswoman from New York. She doesn't hold or wield that much power, but they made it seem like she was the most powerful person in the world and she was going to turn our country into raving socialist and it was going to be dangerous for everybody and the jobs would go away and all this scary stuff, and it worked. Why don't we make Republicans into the party of MTG the same way that
they
did
that? Well, I
think
that's happening. I mean, that's happening this week. The sad thing is that the media is already hand-wringing about, are we paying too much attention to her?
Pay attention to her. Only yeah. Pay attention to her. Don't talk about anything else. Make them answer for her.
That's what they're about. That's what the coup was about. It was about people like her in various iterations of her, even if they're not straight QAnon believers, who used misinformation as their campaign power, as their, that's what they politicked on. They threw aside actual principles and core ideas and just ideas altogether for, paranoid, angry misinformation. That's what the party is about. That's who they are, right? And if they don't strip her of her committee assignments, if they don't censure the Ted Cruz's and Josh Hawley's who fomented these things, then they got to live with it. They have to live with them being the face of the party.
I honestly, for Democratic moral reasons, I want her out. For political reasons, I hope they fucking keep her, because then they will have to, if Democrats have a smart brain cell in their head, Democrat, the figurative person, they will, for the next 2 years until the midterm election, for the next 4 years until the presidential election, they will talk about nothing else. They can do all the things that we want them to do and legislatively focus on all the things. The only thing that they should talk about in interviews is MTG. Make the Republicans the party that stands for what she has fomented and what she stands for. And I do think that that's a winning political strategy.
I agree. And the guy we're about to hear from is hoping that she will be marginalized or go away so that sort of quote unquote more reasonable forces in the party can take over. I'm skeptical. I'm sure that a lot of other people are going to be skeptical even hearing him today.
But I'm willing to hear him out, and maybe I'll be convinced. I haven't gotten to listen to the interview yet. You just did it. So maybe next week I come back and I'm singing a different tune. I'm completely won over.
Well, you, dear listener, can make your own determinations. And we'll come back next week and see where we are. We'll be in the middle of an impeachment trial in the Senate.
Fun.
It's kind of fun. I'm going to put that in air quotes because I'm not sure how much fun it's going to be, but it's going to be damned fascinating.
Either way, we'll be here to talk through it all, and we'll be more informed having listened to this next interview. So let's get to it.
This is Inside the Hive.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They could go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
Congressman Adam Kissinger, welcome to Inside the Hive. We are in a momentous week. In advance of another momentous week, next week, the Senate is going to decide whether to impeach Donald Trump for the coup on January 6th. But this week is sort of a canary in the coal mine, I guess you'd call it. Tell us a little bit about what the conversation was like yesterday around the fate of Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia.
Yeah, look, it was an interesting conference. I think it went on about 4 hours or so, and which is long. Politicians don't have a great attention span. But I think the bottom line is, it appeared that everybody was ready to move on from Marjorie Taylor Greene. she, you know, was somewhat contrite, but I didn't hear, you know, really an apology, but, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
But the big thing is, you know, Liz Cheney survived, and she survived huge. And that was after, you know, a lot of the people that, frankly, you know, were out there trying to minimize what happened on January 6th said they were going to be able to depose her. Well, the reality is, it's, you know, if they're uncomfortable because of Liz Cheney, that's fine. But maybe they should actually be looking at, you know, the president for making them uncomfortable for pushing this thing in the first place. So it's going to be, you know, certainly I think it's the opening shots, not of a war or anything, but really of a fight for what the soul of the Republican Party is. And that may be, you know, a long process.
And today there's going to be a vote on whether to remove her from the committees that she's on. Can you give us a preview of how you're going to come down on that?
Yeah, I mean, short of, you know, her coming out and basically directly apologizing before the vote, I'll be voting for it. It is a bad precedent because I don't know if often or ever, you know, the majority party has made a decision on committees like this, you know, of a minority party. But that said, you know, faced with what's in front of me, which is, should she be on the, you know, education committee, given some of the, you know, false flag commands or implications, then, you know, the reality is no, she shouldn't. So I'll vote for it. I don't know how many of my colleagues join me. It'll be more than me, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, too big of a number because, you know, people are just compelled by this idea that, you know, it's not up to the Democrats to dictate our policy. Typically, I agree with that, except that in this case, it's quite a bit different.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because yesterday's vote about Liz Cheney was a secret ballot.
Yeah,
it allowed some anonymity. Mm-hmm. And how much do you think that had to do with how the votes came out?
I think it had some to do with it. You know, there wasn't really a choice to even do a non-secret ballot. That's just the rules and
The nature of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was good, though, because it sends the message that, you know, this kind of, I don't know if you call it the Donald Trump wing, it's probably not really even, you know, as much of a measure on Trump, but as much on, you know, we're going to be a party that has all kinds of views and doesn't punish people for a vote of conscience. You know, look, I think it was a very strong message. And I do think what it shows is that, you know, had there been a secret ballot on impeachment, for instance, which of course there wouldn't be, but in theory, you certainly would have gotten more than 10 of us because, you know, there was a lot of political pressure. And, you know, the whole idea here is we've got to start speaking truth to power. We got to start just telling the truth and doing it in an optimistic way instead of this cowering in fear.
Well, there's so much, you know, courage, as you well know, in politics is often directly related to the cold math of whichever district you're in and what your base is telling you. You know, I think that quote unquote apology yesterday was its own kind of calculation for her survival, for instance.
Yeah.
And I also want to ask you about, you know, Kevin McCarthy's, you know, pretending he didn't know what QAnon was. I mean, that was pathetic, frankly, you know, and talk about calculated. I mean, you know, Kevin McCarthy, and you may like him as a person, but putting yourself into his shoes, what is he dealing with right now?
Well, he's dealing with a lot of pressure. I do like him as a person. You know, the pressure is from obviously from Donald Trump himself, from then on the other side, people like me and Liz and others. And look, but, you know, I guess I can look at it and say, I appreciate the pressure, but being a leader, you know, the minority leader, is about leading. And it means taking, in many cases, taking arrows for your people, for the people that are, you know, with you in the caucus. And we all know, I mean, we all know he knows what QAnon is. And we all know he knows how you say QAnon. And so it was surprising for me, you know, he said it both in the caucus meeting and then, you know, on the press conference afterwards, he mispronounced QAnon and then said he doesn't know any of it. Like, of course he does. And if he doesn't, he should, because this has been the thing that's been driving, frankly, at least the last 2 months of politics and longer. And so the answer isn't to try to keep all factions of the party together for unity's sake. To some extent, that's important. But when you have something like not even being able to tell truth to power and being honest about what happened on January 6th, that's not leading a party at all. That's actually keeping the party where I think we've been, which is we've become unmoored to our past, to what we stand for, and, you know, quite honestly, to principle.
Well, and the problem that McCarthy faces and other congresspeople is what they're dealing with at home, right? Yeah. The base. I mean, the most offensive thing about him mispronouncing QAnon is he's assuming that there's a bunch of people out there who are idiots,
yeah,
right? Who are going to buy that he doesn't know what it is. And I'd just be curious, you voted to impeach Trump. You were among that small group. And, just to let our listeners know, you're representing the 16th district in Illinois. It's like basically suburban Chicago, right? And you've probably got a little more leeway than some of these other people in terms of threading the needle and being more moderate. Is that roughly accurate?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's a very strong Donald Trump district, and it's mostly rural. And, you know, the reality, so I know being from Illinois, that's people's impression. This was a vote that was not good for me politically, at least in the short term. I do think in the long term, people are going to wake up to it. But there was no political decision in the vote. For me, it was entirely a vote of conscience because, you know, I'm the only one of the 700,000 people I represent that has to take an oath to the Constitution in this capacity. To me, it was a constitutional decision, an oath-keeping decision.
Tell me then a little bit about some of the blowback. I mean, we're talking about political math here, then the calculus of these politicians trying to kind of like keep their base on their side, the base that Trump more or less created or energized. And so now you're opposing them or you're telling them, hey, you've been kind of led astray here. What's the reaction?
You know, it's mixed. I mean, I've gotten a lot of people that have reached out that said thanks. You know, like we felt, you know, that even if they were massive Donald Trump supporters, January 6th changed a lot. You know, the day after the election with the election was stolen narrative, that changed a lot. So I've gotten a lot of outreach from that perspective, which has actually been pretty heartening. And of course, yeah, there's been blowback, you know, but like yesterday in one of my county GOPs, there was a move to censure me and it was beat 11-2. So they didn't censure. There's people that understand, maybe they agree with me. And even if they don't, you know, it was a vote based on conscience. And we have to be a party that accepts that. So it's kind of been mixed. But again, I think the key is, and maybe it says too much about our kind of political state, that, you know, somebody leading and just trying to tell the truth is so out of the norm. But that's all I'm trying to do is just tell people the truth, because short of that, they're hearing no other narrative except the election was stolen and, you know, it wasn't.
Well, you know, I have to say that I live in upstate New York and, you know, I drive around and to this day, there's still Trump flags up.
Yeah.
Right. There's still people who are very much still believing that the election was stolen, still find themselves, you know, they're clinging to this thing. You know, they're holding tight to Trump, and that's something you're probably dealing with in one way or another in your district.
Yeah, and keep in mind, too, part of the reason that they believe that is there's been nobody that said otherwise, you know, with a few exceptions. But, you know, that's the whole part of the QAnon thing anyway, is that, you know, all of this is planned. There's going to be a secret awakening moment, and, you know, that led up. And I think there's even some hangers-on that still somehow believe that maybe Joe Biden is now, you know, part of QAnon. And I mean, it's just gotten so crazy. But that's when you are told that over and over again, and there's not anybody out refuting it. And in fact, the party is to an extent almost tolerating it, desperate for votes. I mean, that's respectable.
Well, beyond tolerating, promoting it. I mean, in some cases with, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, but also just through winks and nods, congresspeople like Jim Jordan have, you know, fanned some of this election fraud stuff, which is completely connected with the QAnon fantasy conspiracy. There was an article recently in the, I think it was in the Times, or talking about what Liz Cheney's been dealing with in Wyoming. And they interviewed somebody who had believed in the election fraud thing, and she decided after looking into it that it was not right, and she said, I was in some kind of fog. I don't know how else to describe it. And that really struck me, because I interviewed a guy on this podcast a few weeks ago about he was a cult expert, you know, in deep programming people from having been in cults. And he said, you know, he sees people who have been involved in QAnon and really Trump devotion at the deepest sort of social media levels, and described it as that's what it is. You have to deprogram them. And it reminded me of something you told David Axelrod recently. He said, it's like the whole party has been on a Friday night bender, right? And they're waking up on Saturday morning. I mean, don't you think that there's a struggle politically inside the GOP, but there's a longer term struggle to carefully bring your, you know, voters out of that belief system?
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, the key is, as you look at this, you know, on the one hand, we have to be careful not to paint, you know, every Trump supporter as, you know, something crazy, right? I voted for Donald Trump in 2020. I wasn't, you know, thrilled about the opportunity, but I did. But a lot changed the day after the election. And I think the key is to say, look, you know, support of Donald Trump in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's where we go now. And it's simply repeatedly saying the truth to people. You know, they're in a fog, yes, but they're not going to be fed as much as they were, you know, with Donald Trump out of power, especially with not having a Twitter account. And yeah, it is like, I mean, I think the best example, it is like Saturday morning after one of those Friday night benders in the party now, and everybody in the party has a choice. I mean, when you're feeling bad on a Saturday morning, the easy answer, you know, is to take a Bloody Mary and just feel a little better and start up again. And maybe if it's a Saturday, you can, you know, let's say it's
Sunday. you sound like you're speaking from experience.
You know, a little bit. You can take that Bloody Mary and just get rolling again and push off the pain. Or you can, you know, just take a look at what you did, deal with that, bear the pain a little bit, the consequences, and hope you're a stronger, better person for it. And that's what we have as a party, the opportunity to do. And that's why I've been so outspoken, is not to offend anybody or make anybody mad, but to tell people the truth.
This is Inside the Hive.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again at an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Well, you're up against a lot. You know, you've got, you know, obviously what's going on with Congresswoman Green, who President Trump has called a quote unquote future Republican star.
Right.
When you just said that you voted for Donald Trump, I knew that. I had that here in my research. It kind of flummoxed me. I was thinking about, you know, a year ago you were telling people about QAnon. You were sort of early in your party to identify this as a problem and to try to come out and kind of inform people that this was a dangerous road.
Yep.
How and why did you start to understand what QAnon was and the danger it was posing to your party?
Yeah. So, and I hope we get into the Donald Trump vote, because I think it's an important discussion. But first off, you know, it was about a year ago when I really started to put the pieces together of what QAnon was, and I had heard a lot of the conspiracies, you know, surrounding it, but you know, it's really when I started kind of waking up to this is really an organized and kind of singular focused thing. And but I had been taking on conspiracy theories for quite a while. You know, if I look back on, I remember in 2015, I think, or 2014, there was this whole thing of Jade Helm, which was where the federal government was going to overthrow the government of Texas. And it was so ludicrous, but even the Texas governor, instead of saying, "This is silly, guys," he said, "Well, I'm going to activate the Texas State Guard," which isn't the National Guard. It's like the Civil Air Patrol for the National Guard. But you know, not because he believed that there was anything to be concerned about, but because it was easier to do that than tell people it was crazy. And, you know, I've been kind of looking through this era where there's a ton of that. So as I started to see this QAnon stuff, I said, you know, look, we got to nip this in the bud. Some people got upset at me for even giving it attention. And I said, I think we're actually already too late. I think it's too late to even stop it. And unfortunately, I was proven correct.
I just, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, everybody has had a revelation somewhere along the line that Donald Trump was unfit to be president.
Yeah.
You know, really the bright line for me was many years ago when you had the Charlottesville event, but also when he stood next to Putin and did not defend his own government.
Yep. You know?
So flash forward to 2020, and you voted for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bring me into the calculus there. What were you thinking?
Well, first off, I didn't vote for him in 2016. And then, you know, he gets sworn in and puts good people around him that obviously over time he starts to shed away. I think knowing what I know today, if I had that value of foresight, I wouldn't have voted for him in 2020. But at the time, it really is a thing. I had to take the calculation of, okay, policy, right? What is the policies going forward? And this is where people that are trying to kind of, I don't know if you want to call it deprogram the cult or kind of take on QAnon, this is where they make huge mistakes. And I see it all the time, like on Twitter, they'll say, well, Adam's, you know, disingenuous because he voted with Donald Trump 86% of the time. Well, all that says is that I voted with the Republican agenda 86% of the time. By the way, I'm a Republican, right? I mean, I'm a conservative Republican. I'm not ashamed of that. I'm proud of that. I think we have a great, rich history. And so, yeah, I will support those policies, but I also think that part of that rich history is telling people the truth. So I don't think it is necessarily incongruent. You know, first off, I didn't endorse Donald Trump in 2020. I was the only Republican member of Congress in Illinois not on his reelection team. I have stood up and said things whenever that was necessary. But when it came down to just the vote on policy, I took a vote. But that said, after the election, when he began to undermine the whole electoral system, and I think was even a bigger threat to democracy than just saying unhinged things, that's when I became even more outspoken than I was.
Well, you know, on some level, I sometimes think of the Trump, you know, in sympathetic moments, I think of the Trump base as really victims to some degree of Trump's, you know, campaign to misinform them, which obviously the Twitter platform gave him all that power. But what's the excuse of these other politicians who, like Green and others, who see an opportunity? It's almost like a parlor trick, you know, if you're a politician, you're like, well, we've gotten to the point now where we don't even really even have to tell the truth. We can come up with a whole new set of alternative facts and campaign on those. And it has almost like a magic, for a while there, it had a magic touch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A guy like Jim Jordan could just, you know, he just was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yeah.
Which is just, ridiculous. I mean, you know, Jake Tapper was on here a couple of months ago, and he said one of the great unexplored aspects of public life is how many of these people are just possibly batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Themselves. Right. We think the followers, maybe they're crazy on their 4chan message boards, but you deal with these people directly in the halls of Congress. And I'm always asking myself, are they crazy or are they crazy like a fox? You know, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think there's some that are crazy, some that are crazy like a fox. You know, look, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene, after hearing her last night in the conference, speak somewhat rationally. I mean, I don't think she apologized. I didn't hear apologies, but I heard some rationalization. And I realized she's a very smart lady, you know. And I think, so I've become convinced that with her, it's more about fame. It's more about following. It's more about fundraising. And I think that's a big, as much of a problem as anything, is people have seen that you can become instantly famous by tweeting and saying absolutely crazy stuff. And you can raise a ton of money and make this job easier and be worshipped among, you know, your constituents or base for that. And but there are some, there are a few that I think truly buy into some of this crazy stuff. But I think the vast majority, you look at the ones that are particularly, you know, Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene, maybe Jim Jordan, that just to them, it's either the end justifies the means and it's, you know, win at all costs, or it's just, hey, I could be, I mean, look, nobody would know who Marjorie Taylor Greene was. Except for the fact that she tweeted a whole bunch of crazy stuff, and now she's way more famous than probably most politicians. I think that's what she wants.
Right. Well, and it goes to the problem of the entire system that we're all working through here, the social media, the internet. You know, Trump was the, you know, the great fusion of the entertainment and political complexes. You know, I mean, is he a politician? Is he an entertainer? Is he just a guy who's out to make money? We never kind of knew. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's created all these little mini Trumps.
That's right.
So next week, there's a lot of senators who are going to have in the Republican Party who are going to have a choice to make. And I wonder how much what's happened this week is going to recalibrate their own calculations about how they vote or give them cover to not vote for impeachment. How do you see what's happened this week kind of informing what we might see next week?
I don't know. I think Mitch McConnell coming out against Marjorie Taylor Greene was great. I think, you know, obviously this vote was huge, on Liz Cheney. But I just don't know. I think part of it's going to be is Trump's defense crazy? You know, they try to put up a good fight and say he didn't have time for, you know, you can't prove he did this or he didn't have time for whatever. It'll be interesting to see. But I do think when you start to see polling that says, you know, 20% less Republican support for Donald Trump running again than there was even a few weeks ago, it's starting to show what I had been suspecting from the very beginning and still predict, which is within about 6 months, I think Donald Trump will, you know, potentially be a pariah in the Republican Party, or at least a 50% support figure instead of, you know, 70 or 80, because people move on. He doesn't have Twitter. He's not blinding people. Saturday morning fog. And I think folks are going to wake up to this is not the future of you can love him and never have to disown him, but I think you can look at this rationally and say the party of Trump is not the party that's going to be in the majority in the future.
Yeah. I mean, that's the choice that these senators have is if you ban Trump from running for future office, that goes a long way towards determining the direction of the party. Don't you agree?
It does. It does. And it takes them out. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. I had a very revealing moment. I was in Vegas shortly after the election, and somebody had said to me, I mean, somebody had recognized me just in Vegas. I was there for military, not the party. And so somebody had said to me, recognized me. She came up, she and her husband, we know you, et cetera. Cool. And she said, well, you know, what do you think about this election? You know, it was stolen. And I pushed back and I go, no, you know, Donald Trump, he lost, he's out. And she goes, oh, that's depressing. Well, you know, at least he's going to run again in 2024. And I go, no, I hate to tell you, he's not going to run again in 2024. The guy's just, he's not going. She goes, wow, well, that's terrible for the party. At least Don Jr. will run then. And it was really revealing to me, which is there are people that have, because of, for whatever reason, have equated Donald Trump with Republicanism. And they see Donald Trump as the only way Republicanism can survive. Well, he's done that. Well, the reality is we've got to show an alternative vision. That was part of like when I launched thiscountryfirst.com, which is like saying, look, this is a country first party, not a Donald Trump first party. We can be successful together and we're going to go forward and be successful together. And that's what that's all about.
I just have to question, what does the Republican Party even represent anymore?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Trump to me was always like kind of like a pastiche of different emotions and less like a set of policy ideas, right? And, you know, you have very definitive conservative ideas. I take it you're anti-abortion. You're against you voted against the Equality Act. You're against legalization of marijuana. Do you believe in climate change?
Yeah. And by the way, I am for gay marriage and, I'm on the legalization issue. I'm probably in the middle on that. So,
right. Well, I just, you know, when we come out the other side of this, and I've always wondered, maybe you can tell me, like, people who voted for Trump, do you think they were voting largely on conservative principles, or what policies and ideas do you think he best represented? Because to me, it seems like anti-immigration, you know, this is the critique from the left, and you can respond to this, but that largely that there was a undercurrent of racism, white working class resistance to diversity.
Yeah, I don't think that's totally inaccurate. I think it's turned into a battle. Look, I mean, I think we have to, if somebody's on the left, they need to look in the mirror and say, you know, to an extent, the left has been pushing, you know, a lot of the times kind of a narrative that I think has disaffected the working class. It's kind of this narrative from the East and West Coast elites, and they felt disaffected. Meanwhile, the same kind of difficulties that hit the inner city are the difficulties hitting the rural town, right? Loss of jobs, there's drug use, there's families that fall apart. It's the same kind of issues. And frankly, I think they take the same prescriptions. But, and they felt disaffected. And Donald Trump came along, and it wasn't really about conservative policies. I think it was about own the left and push back against the left and attack the left. And that felt good. If you feel like you've been left behind, that felt good. The problem is we've lost what it means to be a conservative. And, you know, for me, there's a lot of issues I'm fairly moderate in. Economically, I'm fairly conservative, but we can go down the litany of issues. And the reality is what I believe is that a kid born in the inner city should have the same opportunity as a kid born in the richest suburb. That's what makes me a conservative. And the policies to get there, you know, those will change over time. Those will change with the day. And frankly, those will change by people's perception. But that's what we need to get back to. And that's going to be that long haul battle.
This is Inside the Hive.
So you started a pack called Country First. Mm-hmm. So what are you trying to achieve here? You're trying to basically draw a line in the sand and create some political energy around kind of directing the party away from Trump. Is that more or less what you're doing?
Yeah. So it's there's a pack associated with it. I didn't create this for the PAC. I didn't create it to raise money. Basically, I just did a video that I wanted to just, I'll call it kind of my manifesto, like my way to say, look, here's the great past of the party, freeing the slaves, women's suffrage, things like that. And here's where we've been in the last few years. I mean, we had an insurrection, you know, a dead police officer took their own lives. And here's where we need to go. So I really just created it as a video that just says what I was thinking, and then a place for people to land, to come and leave your email. Let's figure out where this goes. And man, the response has been incredible. And I would encourage people to go to countryfirst.com. It's with a 1ST, because watch the video, and because the response has been incredible from Republicans, from some Democrats that say we just need a healthy party, and from people that have left the party or considering leaving the Republican Party. And so we're taking this day by day and figuring out where to go with this as it grows. And I think my intention, my hope, is that it leads to a serious movement to fight for the future of the Republican Party. One that people can, whether you disagree with the policies or not, you can respect on the political scene.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think the Washington Post did a story about this PAC and quoted Joe Walsh, you know, the never Trumper Republican of Illinois. And I just want to read this really quickly. If there was any political calculation, and he's talking about yours, it's to be one of the leaders of the anti-Trump wing of the Republican Party. And he said, and I give him credit for that. I just don't think they have a prayer.
Well, there's no calculation. I certainly don't want to be the leader of anything. I think, you know, if you look at what's happened with Donald Trump over time and how he changed people's views, we have to have something to counter that to bring people back. That's the only hope. And I think it's going to work. Quite honestly, the response has been amazing.
Do you think that, based on what you know and the people you talk to in Congress, that McConnell has any intention of whipping the votes together to make impeachment happen next week?
I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting to see what he does. You know, does he come out and say, you know, I'm going to vote to remove. Keep in mind, he just got reelected. He's probably not going to run again. And now he's thinking about legacy. You know, he's held his cards close to his vest. I think that gives what he does will be very telling. And it's one of those kind of a day by day. We'll figure out the future of this party by how it goes day by day. And, you know, I think if we talk again in a week, it'll be a lot different.
Let's pan back a little bit and think about history. We've been living in it and we're living day to day and week to week in it. And we don't know how it'll look in the rear view, but we can guess. This has been a massive event, a rupture in our history, which none of us have, you know, seen in our lifetime. You and I are, you know, more or less like Gen X age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're just in uncharted territory. And I think about the long-term legacy of people like Jim Jordan, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, who probably will not face any consequence as a result of fanning the election fraud thing and voting against certification, as over 100 people did in Congress. How do you think these people are going to look in the larger scheme of history?
I just think the next few days or next few months will be telling. I think, you know, whether or not they get punished, I think is secondary to, are they going to be a player anymore? And I don't think so. I think they've done a lot to damage themselves. And I think, you know, they probably, you know, they may be senators, but maybe not leaders of the party, thought leaders, that is. I mean, keep in mind, the Republican brand was really damaged after Richard Nixon. And 4 years later, we got Ronald Reagan and the Republican brand was reborn. So it's not unthinkable. And history points to the fact that the Republican Party can come back strong, but it's not going to come back strong with the same people.
Well, that is that's a bold prediction. It's an optimistic one, frankly. And, you know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And we're going to find out next week which way the political winds are blowing, or maybe not next week. It could take a while for this trial to unfold. But thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And just one little factoid I want to point out to listeners is that you went to a high school called Normal Community.
That's right.
High school. So you represent what we hope is going to be the normal community going forward. Have a great day and good luck.
You bet. Thanks. Good talking to you.
And that's our episode this week. I'd like to thank our guest, Congressman Adam Kinziger. And I'd like to thank our co-host, Emily Jane Fox. If you liked this episode of Inside the Hive, please subscribe. Go to Apple or radio.com or wherever you get your podcasts and hit subscribe. I'd like to thank our new executive producer, Brett Fuchs, and our production team at Cadence 13. I'd also like to thank our sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast, and we'll see you next week.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.